This is Sacred Tension, the podcast about the discipline of asking questions and where we try to have compassionate conversations about challenging subjects. My name is Stephen Bradford Long, and joining us once again is my friend Jonathan Rauch, author of The Constitution of Knowledge, Kindly Inquisitors, and so on. He wrote a fantastic article in The Atlantic called The U.S. Should Apologize to Gay People, and it is a kind of harrowing exploration of the history of the U.S. government's war on gay people. So we will be talking about that. He is back to make trouble. We got up to some mischief last time, and maybe we'll make some more mischief. We'll see. But before we get to that, do please become a subscriber to my Substack. I do all kinds of interesting stuff there. I have weekly essays. I have paid essays where I do a roundup of interesting stuff I find around the internet. I have a paid subscriber show called House of Heretics. And I also occasionally post some meditations. We do live meditations. It is an active, thriving community over there at the Sacred Tension Substack. All kinds of super interesting people from a broad religious and political spectrum, and that is what we are all about here, is finding commonality, finding common ground in our shared human experience. So, if that interests you, then please become a paying subscriber. You start the article with just this harrowing story that was heartbreaking of a young man who was a foreign affairs officer or something. How do you pronounce his last name, by the way?
Kirch. It's spelled K-R-C. It's a Czech name.
Jan Kirch.
There's a Jan Kirch. Yeah, they have Jan vowel Kirch. Shortages. Okay. They have vowel shortages in that part of the world. There was once a proposal during the Kosovo War to do a massive airlift of vowels to Bosnia.
So, Jan Kirch, tell us his story.
Jan was born in what was then Czechoslovakia, behind what was then the Iron Curtain. His family ran into trouble with the communist regime. His, I think, paternal grandfather, one of his grandfathers, was forced to work in forced labor for 5 years in a uranium mine for listening to the Voice of America. His father was a physician, but refused to toe the party line, join the party, and for that was essentially had a stalled career. They lost their apartment. The whole family, that was four people, father, mother, two kids, were forced to move into a two-room flat with the grandmother, and it got pretty desperate. So one night when Jan was, man, I'm going to forget the exact ages now, but I think he's like 10 or 12. He's not that young. Jan now is, I think he's born in 1956. So in about 1968, his father takes the two kids and makes a dash for the border. And Jan told me that he still remembers hitchhiking their way to the border, sleeping in a train station, and finally making their way across to Austria, where they were able to find asylum. And ultimately, Jan came to the United States. He told me that his proudest moment, or one of them, was when in his later teens, he took the oath of citizenship. And all he wanted was to serve this country, to give back. So he joined the U.S. Foreign Service, what was then called the U.S. Information Agency, and is now part of the Department of State. And his first job was successful, his first posting. He flew back to Washington on the way to his second posting. He's now in his mid-20s. He's on his way to South Africa, he thinks. When he gets notice that he needs to report for a debriefing at the headquarters of the USIA. So he goes in there suspecting nothing and encounters two men in the kind of cheap suits that two men in the USIA would wear, in a small conference room. And the first half hour is pretty normal. They ask him questions about his posting and what he learned. And then about 30 minutes in, they said, have you had homosexual sex since the age of 18. And he thinks, oh shit. It suddenly dawns on him what this is. They spend the next 8.5 hours drilling him mercilessly with questions about who came to the embassy. Did he have sex with any of them? They really want to know who else in the USIA, in the Foreign Service, might be homosexual. He gets one brief break for lunch when he's able to run down and get a drink and a sandwich. They tell them if he's truthful, that he'll soon be on his way to Cape Town. He believes them. He thinks the government and he are on the same side because, after all, he's a patriotic citizen. He's given good service in his job. He figures, well, when this ends, I'll move on with my career, which is what they tell him. In the end, he winds up signing a document confessing to his homosexuality and is allowed to leave. By the way, he asked for counsel during this interview and was told he really didn't need it and he'd be better off without it, and all he had to do was tell the truth and he'd be fine. Of course, he was lying. I'm sorry, he was not lying. They were lying. Mm-hmm. The guys in the suits had no intention of allowing him to go to South Africa. In those days, not all that long ago, remember, this is 1983. It is the policy of the U.S. government that homosexuals are a security risk. He is parked in an office in a cultural exchange program for 9 years. They want him to quit. That's the game here. He does not quit, but they also won't give him a recommendation for another job. So he can't even get a gig giving tours in the capital because you need recommendations for stuff like that. So he's parked at this job. He decides to fight. Not everybody does. Most people really don't want to have a fight with the U.S. government, which does not want them to serve. But he decides to go through the grievance procedure and try to get his job back. That means that he's going to be in the news, and that means he has to call his parents and he has to tell them that he's gay because he doesn't want them to read about it in the newspaper. This is a very hard conversation and it goes badly. His mother stays in bed for 5 days with depression. His parents prevail on him to see a hypnotist to change him. This causes a family rupture, as of course it so often did. In the 1980s, parents were terrified if their kids were gay. If nothing else, you could die of AIDS. So his family life is ruptured. His grievance process starts. The very first thing that's said by the government lawyer in the very first grievance proceeding is, Mr. Kirch is an open and notorious homosexual. He loses at the grievance proceeding. Eventually, he loses in federal court. He does not get his job back. What finally happens is in 1993, the Clinton administration comes in and they have a different attitude. And Kirch is allowed to reapply for the Foreign Service and does so and is admitted and goes on to have a full and good career. And retired a couple of years ago. He's now, I think, 66 or 67. Again, not old. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, the story works out. But only after 10 years of having his career upended, his family life disrupted. He was terrified the first year or more that this process went on. He lost a lot of weight. He lost his sex life. He became depressed and anxious, as you would if your government considered you a security threat, and had destroyed the one thing that you really wanted to do in life. And through it all, there's a thought that he can't get out of his mind, which is, my family fled communism because America was supposed to be different. It was supposed to be the place that promised the freedom to live as who we authentically are. It's a free country. And here I am being treated in this way that is so eerily reminiscent of the totalitarian regime that I left behind. And he's not the only one who thinks that. Thousands of people were fired from or forced out of the State Department over the course of, starts in the 1940s, and it lasts until the 1990s.
Do we know?
Forced out of the military until 2010.
Do we know who these people were, or are they just lost to history?
They're mostly lost to history.
Yeah.
There has never been any kind of concerted effort to identify the victims. That's in pretty sharp contrast to, for example, the victims of lynching. We have a pretty good idea who those are and how many there were. Records have been found. There's a museum in, I think, Mississippi, where you can find their names and memorials to them. There's been nothing like that for the homosexual victims of government persecution. Most disappeared into the woodwork. Many of them lost their careers, their family connections, their friendships. They were pariahs, they were ashamed, so they would disappear. Often they were not even telling their families what was happening. There's documents about people who were fired, forced out. The government was very proud of this activity. The FBI, for example, kept files. But getting that information has been very difficult. For some reason, the government seems to be reluctant to own up. So there's an organization, it's a great group, it's called the Mattachine Society of Washington, D.C. It goes right back to the beginning of the gay civil rights movement. And in fact, the Mattachine Society back in the early 1980s helped Jan Kirch. They helped him find a lawyer. The ACLU helped him too. God bless him. So the Mattachine Society is still around, and it's now devoted to archive activism. Mm. And trying to recover the documents. It's using lawsuits, FOIAs. It's encouraging people who have records, you know, maybe their uncle or their father, grandfather, grandmother, to submit those records. It's encouraging the establishment of university archives. So there are efforts underway to try to collect some of this stuff, but nothing that comes close to a national reckoning with what was done.
And the federal piece, and again, the federal war against federal employees, that I think is what people think of. They think of the Red Scare. They think of it, if they're more historically literate, they know about the Lavender Scare, which is what we're talking about. But the federal government was just a piece. It was maybe the piece that launched this, that instigated this. But what you're describing in this article is a society-wide, disparate, decentralized network of oppression. Talk about that wider network in terms of police, states, just, you know, families, colleges. Just talk about that wider network and what it was like to live under this system of totalitarianism.
Yeah, that word totalitarianism, but before we get into the details, could we just pause on that word for a moment?
Absolutely.
And understand it. So in political theory, totalitarianism is often considered different from authoritarianism. In authoritarianism, you have a strong, undemocratic, usually oppressive government. But it generally leaves you alone if you're not involved in politics. So government of, you know, Argentina under the junta might be that sort of thing. Some might argue Putin's government is like that. Whereas the Soviet Union was totalitarianism because it actually cared what a composer like Dmitri Shostakovich was writing. Now, we need to be forthright about this. In the United States, we have had more severe regimes of oppression than what I'm about to describe. We have had the mass relocation of Native Americans in barbaric and brutal ways. And of course, we have slavery and terrorism and Jim Crow, which people were physically enslaved, beaten, tortured, lynched, and all of that. By all of that, I don't mean to sound dismissive. But what was done to homosexuals was different from those things because, first, it wasn't just one level of government or the government. It was all of society. Every channel of society was repurposed for the goal. And what was the goal? It's the totalitarian goal, which is ultimately mind control. It's seeking to erase the very concept of homosexuality for American life. It's seeking to make it completely disappear. So one way to do that is big centralized regime, you know, Soviet Union model, the Nazi model. That's kind of how we think about 20th century totalitarianism, 1984, Orwell. But there's another way to do it, and that's a decentralized way to do it, where multiple levels of government and multiple institutions in society, all separately but in coordination, act to shut off every channel of independent activity and thought. And that's what was done. So in 1945, right after the World War II ends and the Cold War begins, homosexuality becomes conflated in the minds of policymakers and then the public with communism as part of a subversive plot. The State Department begins its crackdown. The government announces that it won't hire homosexuals. J. Edgar Hoover and the FBI begin an anti-pervert campaign. And what's known as the Lavender Scare commences, just as you said. The Lavender Scare is, you know, it's a lot of people have heard about it. And they think of it as, yeah, the government fires a few hundred, maybe a few thousand homosexuals. Far more people were fired in the Lavender Scare than the Red Scare, because there actually were homosexuals. There weren't that many communists. But so they kind of tend to think of it as this isolated thing that happened in Washington, D.C. in the 1950s. What the Lavender Scare did, however, is the federal government created a permission structure that then engaged and recruited every other level of government to do the same thing. So at the same time, you had state governments and localities that had, since the 1920s, begun to ramp up their prosecution of homosexuals under statutes. Of course, they all had sodomy laws, which criminalized homosexuality per se. But the bulk of the work was done by using statutes on things like loitering, public nuisance, inappropriate gathering, obscenity, lewdness, all of these statutes that states and localities had on the books. And starting in the mid-40s, they've already been ramping this stuff up for 20 or 30 years because homosexuals are beginning to congregate in cities and become visible. Starting in the 40s, they go wild with this stuff. It becomes standard practice in cities across America to surveil the parks, the bars, the clubs. Congregations of gay men would be disrupted and arrested under laws like loitering. It's not that you couldn't have sex together. That's, of course, illegal. But homosexuals could not actually meet in congregations or groups. They'd be accused of, for example, loitering. They were arrested in bars. Bar raids were a favorite police tactic because it could rack up their arrest scores. It was notoriously easy to arrest homosexuals. They didn't want to resist because they were hoping to not get their names in the paper and lose their jobs the next day. Of course, they did get their names in the paper and lose their jobs the next day. This went on in cities across America, large and small, for decades. Hundreds of thousands of people were prosecuted, arrested. Many were simply released the next day or given misdemeanor tickets. Now, that sounds like it's not very important, but guess what? That would be reported in the press. They now had criminal records, or they were now exposed publicly. So if you were a teacher, for example, or a nurse, or a professional, or really almost anything, you'd lose your job the next day. And that's the real goal. You terrify homosexuals such that any hint of exposure, showing themselves publicly, holding hands in public, congregating, even talking to other gay people, could be the end of your career. I have a cousin. He's a bit older than I am. He missed by, he thinks, about half an hour, a bar raid in Indianapolis in which 30 gay men were arrested in a bar sweep. And he says they lost their jobs, most of them. If he hadn't been tired and gone home early, he would have been one of them. I mean, this was standard experience for gay people for decades. So that's what the police were doing. We haven't even gotten to psychiatry and all the rest. But so the federal government's just the tip of the iceberg.
And you cover all of this in depth in your article. It is horrifying and shocking, and you make the point, and it's just tragic and hideous, but true, that the war of extermination, this war of erasure, it worked, because we don't know the vast, vast, vast majority of who these people were. So it worked. And then we don't remember it. We don't remember them, and we don't remember this history. So in a way, it was successful. It succeeded. And this actually brings me to a point that I want to discuss with you. And it might sound like it is disconnected, but I think it is very connected. The topic of marriage. Why, in light of this history, is marriage and celebrating the right to marry and actually taking part in that right, why is that important for young people? Because let me pull the curtain back. I had an email exchange with you where we were talking about marriage, and I was like, yeah, I'm not married yet. I've been with my partner for like a decade. And you were like, get thee to a courthouse, were your words.
My advice remains the same. Get thee to the courthouse. What are you waiting for?
Yes. And so why is it important for younger gay people to get married?
Well, I'm not saying everybody has to get married, although you certainly should.
Yeah, true. Yeah.
But
John and I are talking about it. Yeah, well, John is way more of the catch than I am, my partner, but we are talking about it. Yeah.
Remind me to circle back and ask you a question once we get off of marriage.
Okay.
So marriage comes along in a different track, and the marriage movement arises to a very significant extent out of the AIDS crisis. Because homosexuality has been forced deep underground in the 50s, 60s, and continuing to the 70s. But then you get the Stonewall Uprising. You've got a gay civil rights movement, which Frank Kameny, mm-hmm. Jan Kirch's helper, helps to found. You get in 1973 the depathologization, is that a word, of homosexuality? It's no mm-hmm. longer considered mental illness. You begin to get a gay rights movement, but you're still a pariah class. So you don't have the institutions that allow you to have open relationships that are socially acceptable. You can't hold hands in public. You're probably going to get the crap beaten out of you in a lot of parts of America. Probably won't be able to get a job. So there's a lot of sex going on in environments that are pretty uncontained and uncontrolled, and gay people don't have a destination for love. We don't really have a model for finding the right person and settling down with all the blessings of our surrounding community, which is what marriage really brings to the table. It's not just a piece of paper from the government. It's a relationship with your community that understands that you and your partner have a sacred bond, a special bond, that you're going to be there for each other and the community is going to support you as a couple. That's why we call marriage an institution. It's not just a relationship. It's different from cohabitation. Everyone knows to call Jonathan if you get hit by a car And Jonathan knows that that's his duty if you're married, and society's going to support that. The 80s come, the AIDS crisis comes. That crisis is abetted by the fact that we've lacked the social patterns that would allow us to have sexual relationships in more open and direct ways. And we discover we can't get in the hospital room. The people we're supposed to care for, we're considered legally complete strangers to. Wills are contested because a partner, what's that? So the person whose house you share in the long-term relationship, you have nowhere else to live, you're kicked out the day they die because the relatives say, well, that's our house and we're selling it. Goodbye. You can't care for the person. You don't have any of the structures you need. And that really kickstarts the marriage movement. It's born of the very personal, often very brutal recognition that we needed those institutions and those supports. It's also, of course, a civil rights issue. It's an equality issue. And that's there as well. And finally, I grab onto the marriage movement in the 90s when I'm in, I guess, about your age, when I'm 35 or so, because to me, it provides the destination for love to young gay people so that they know from a very early age, as soon as they have those first stirrings and know they're different, that they know there's a direction, a destination for their love. Mm. I thought being gay meant I would never have a settled life in marriage with family and community. And that was true in the 60s and 70s when I was growing up. I thought instead I was fated to a life of subterranean, black market, kind of sexual trysts in places like parks and bathrooms, constantly pursued by my government and considered mentally ill. Also, by the way, a stench in the nostrils of God, thanks to Christian teaching at the time.
Right.
So marriage changes that. Marriage signals to all these kids in America, you know what? You can grow up and you can have that marriage, that place in your community, that recognition, that destination for your loves. You can exchange the vows and the rings, and you can have the honor and the privilege and the responsibility that goes with that. And that changes the experience of being gay and growing up.
It seems to me that a lot of my peers and a lot of Gen Z are really passionate about LGBT rights, but completely detached from the actual history. And I've just been thinking a lot about this after reading your piece, just how precious these rights are. You know, I know that the rights we enjoy now are unprecedented and precious, but reading stuff like what you wrote in The Atlantic, and I've done some other reading over the years about the history, it just puts into sharp relief just how rare and precious these rights are and how important it is to take advantage of them. You said that you had a question for
Yeah,
for me,
that's
though.
Exactly my question for you. You're what, 35, I guess?
I'm mid-30s. Yeah.
So you came along after most of this stuff happened. The military ban doesn't end until 2010.
Yep.
So by then, I guess you're probably, how old were you in 2010? In your 20s? Yeah.
Yeah, I was in my early 20s.
Early 20s. So yeah. That you probably remember.
Yep.
How much of what's in my article do you think gay people, gay and lesbian people, and for that matter, trans people, actually know?
Very little. So the part that I knew was the psychiatric part, because I was in the ex-gay world, and that was my first exposure to the concept of homosexuality. That was the framework that I was given, was reparative therapy, Christian reparative therapy, and ex-gay therapy when I was a teenager. And so Exodus International, all of that stuff, because of my family and who are deeply religious. So all of that old stuff about, you know, homosexuality as an eroticized wound because, you know, you didn't receive you were emasculated as a child and all of that stuff. All of that stuff was still very much in my life. And it almost killed me. I mean, I feel like years of my life was lost to it. That was the battle of my teens and 20s. That was my dragon through teens and 20s, yeah, overcoming that. And so I knew that part, even though at that point it wasn't officially sanctioned by like the American Psychological Association. All of those organizations, all of the flagship organizations had completely denounced homosexuality or had completely denounced reparative therapy. It wasn't mainline in any sense, but I was caught in that subculture, in that Christian subculture. So I knew that, I was aware of that, and I knew above the, as I started to come out of that, I learned about the history of the psychiatry and the psychology and the oppression of homosexuals by psychiatry and psychology. So I knew about that, but the only reason I knew about that was because I was enduring one of the last pockets of it. Otherwise, I had no idea. I didn't know about the Lavender Scare. I didn't know. I knew that there was a general social oppression, but the degree of the just annihilationism, the how deep it went into our society from the top to the bottom, I had no clue. And in fact, it was blatantly denied. I mean, people around me would say, oh no, you know, homosexuals are, this is a myth. The degree to which people were hurt, not by other gay, you know, other gay people weren't saying this, but just conservatives who had their head in the sand were saying this.
Do you think your gay friends, gay and lesbian friends, know more than you do?
No. I feel like I am more educated.
The past is lost to them for the most part.
Yes, to my particular, to people I know and to people younger than me who identify as LGBT, yes, 100%.
So I'm afraid that's also what I've encountered. The version of gay and lesbian history that most people know is oppression, discrimination, Stonewall Riot, liberation.
That's it. That is it. And then Harvey Milk. Harvey Milk is in there.
Harvey Milk, right.
Because
Harvey
of the movie.
Well, but it really has, the whole thing has kind of been collapsed down to the single point of Stonewall.
Stonewall, that's right.
And the mythology that surrounds Stonewall.
And a lot of that mythology is incorrect. They even get the history of Stonewall wrong.
Yes, that is also true.
Yep.
But it is not surprising that people don't know the history because it's not taught.
Yeah.
It's not in the school curriculums. Most kids learn something, I think, about the Red Scares, and they certainly get taught now in a lot of places about the iniquities that were perpetrated against Native Americans and Blacks.
Yes.
But it is still very controversial in a lot of school districts to teach gay and lesbian history. And in fact, right now you have people running around the country pulling those books off of library shelves in schools and public libraries on the grounds that you're teaching things that are unsuitable to children. So we can't say that we should be surprised that people don't know what happened if they haven't been taught it. And we also can't be all that surprised if some of the very same things are happening again right now, admittedly to a much lesser degree, but are still happening right now because we don't remember the past when we're being told that we can't teach about gay and lesbian history or the existence of gay people or the existence of trans people. Mm. Well, that's what we saw in the past. We see some of the same eliminationist rhetoric. Mm. Transgenderism should be eliminated from the country.
Yeah, Michael Knowles said that transgenderism should be, you know, it's super scary to me the degree to which the anti-trans rhetoric that we're seeing in state houses and schools and culturally, how much it mirrors so much of the language that was used against gay people. It's in some cases, it's almost word for word, the similarities. And it's like it has been transposed onto this new population away from gay men and onto this new, not new, but different population of trans people. And that is really scary to me. And the problem with not knowing the history is that if you don't know the history, then you won't see it.
Yeah, that's right. And the other problem with not knowing the history is just the deep injustice.
Yeah.
Like, Jan Kirch is not an old man.
Yeah.
He's pretty much my age. I don't think I'm an old man.
No, you're not. You're a strapping young man.
He's walking around on the streets among us. He endured this terrible injustice. So at the end of the Obama administration, Secretary of State John Kerry published on the State Department website a State Department apology to victims of the Lavender Scare. The State Department was probably the leader in the federal government for witch hunts against homosexual people. They had a whole enforcement squad that would come and find you and get you and roust you out. One of the first things the Trump administration did when it came in was remove that apology. So Jan Kirch got an apology for 2 weeks. But there's been no restitution. I think there should be restitution. There should be reparations for living individuals who were subject to government discrimination. I don't really care what the amount is. That's not really the point. The point is that they deserve a letter in the mail with some kind of recognition and remuneration attached that says, we're sorry. This should not have happened to you. There should be an organized effort by a truth commission to surface the names and the records so that the agencies can't play the games of hide and seek with the documents. So there should be systems in place to get the documents, archive them, go through them, find the names, the people in the FBI files, the people in the State Department files, the people in the state and local police files. That needs to be surfaced. It needs to be counted. We need to know who those people are. We need to make it right for them. We have never done that. Instead, we are still sweeping it under the rug. We are still pretending it never happened.
Why, we can just end on this note. Why is an apology important? You know, I was, your article, you probably don't know this, your article went semi-viral on Reddit yesterday, on the Gay Bros subreddit. A lot of the response was, quote, fuck an apology. A lot of the gay people in that subreddit just roundly rejected the very idea of an apology. So why? I would have to go back and read through it, but I think because they see an apology as empty. I don't think an apology is empty. I think an apology, well, I will ask you, why is an apology important?
So I do understand where folks are coming from. It might seem like an apology is a cheap and easy gesture, though in fact it's not cheap and easy because we've been unable to get one. The federal government apologized formally in 2009 to Frank Kameny. He was last century's, I think, most important LGBT rights activist. He was fired from the U.S. Army MAP service in 1957. He led the civil rights fight for decades and lived long enough, though he never got his job back. In fact, he never worked again after he was fired in the 50s. He lived long enough to get a formal apology from the Office of Personnel Management, which had fired him. And at the time of his apology was headed by a gay man. So we saw that important gesture. But that's all there's been. The Biden administration last year issued a proclamation that condemned the Lavender Scare, but did not apologize for it. And my guess is that's because the politics of saying we're sorry might expose them to a lot of conservative criticism, that they're pandering to grievances. So on the right, you have people who don't want an apology. They're perfectly fine with forgetting about what they did and moving on for obvious reasons. And then you've got people on the left who are saying that doesn't really change anything. It's a cheap gesture. We don't need it. I disagree with both of those things. I think that part of what a great democracy should do is own up to its iniquities, to its oppressions, and to its mistakes. And the way it does that is that the organs of our government, Congress is what we're talking about, the representatives of the people say, you know what? We were wrong. I think it's important that we saw formal Senate apologies for allowing lynchings to go on. Mm-hmm. there were repeated efforts to pass anti-lynching legislation in the 20th century, and they were stymied by Southern senators. I think it's important to recognize that. Massachusetts in the 50s, not recently, apologized for the witch trials. State of Massachusetts. We've seen apologies to Japanese-American victims of internment, which came with restitution for the living people and their families. I think super important. That's one of the great black marks on our democracy, and many more. And other countries have done this, apologies. Some of them have done restitution. And the other thing an apology would do is it would bring some additional attention to what happened. It would help rectify the problem that people just have no idea that the American government, American society, police who are supposed to protect us, were engaging in a campaign of totalitarian oppression. And I think a national apology would help draw some attention to that, as would the other things I mentioned, a truth commission. There needs to be a national museum and archive that can become a clearinghouse for the documents and the stories. All of those things need to be done. You know, how many people know? I mentioned this briefly in the article because I didn't have space. In 1954, a very popular Democratic U.S. Senator from Montana named Lester Hunt went into his office in what's now, I think, the Russell Senate office building with a Winchester rifle and blew his brains out. The reason for that was that he was being blackmailed by several Republican senators because his son was gay.
Oh, that was in the article.
I mentioned it briefly.
Yeah.
There's a lot more to that story. Hmm. It gave rise to a famous movie called Advise and Consent, a novel and a movie. Now, you would think that it would be a big deal, you know, kind of a thing that a U.S. senator blew his brains out in his office in the Capitol. No one knows. No one knows. It's astonishing.
It is astonishing. The other thing an apology would do, apologizing to everyone who suffered physical and psychic torture under this regime, another thing it would do, and you emphasize this in the article, is it would affirm the best parts of our country. It would reaffirm that we are the kind of country, we are the kind of culture that can face its shortcomings and correct itself. And in doing so, it reaffirms the best of our country. It reaffirms the best of our society. And it isn't pandering to grievance. It is reaffirming the integrity of our country that is there. And I think that's also an important point as to what an apology would
do. Important.
Yeah.
Yes, it's a way of expressing our values to ourselves and
yes,
and the world. There have been efforts in Congress to apologize. There was a bill introduced a couple sessions ago called the Love Act. There was another effort by Senator Tim Kaine, who I interviewed last session, to have the State Department apologize for the Lavender Scare. They go nowhere. There's just not much interest in them. Republicans oppose them. Democrats are busy with other things. That should end. Indifference should end. And it should end while Jan Kirch and so many others, my cousin, are still alive. They need to live to see this justice done.
I think that is a great note for us to end on. Thank you, Jonathan. It is always great to see you. And thank you so much for your time. It really means a lot to me. And thank you for your friendship.
Thank you.
Thank you, everyone, for listening. You can find this podcast and my blog at sacredtension.substack.com. Become a paying subscriber. The music for the show is by 11D7. The theme song is Wild. You can find it on Apple Music, Spotify, or wherever you listen to music. The show is written, produced, and edited by me, Stephen Bradford Long. And as always, stay curious, and thanks for listening.